decision time for Governor Scott to veto part or all of the state budget. And charges are being dropped for the so-called Hemming Park Five. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, never miss a show. Download the WJCT app. Listen to us anytime or on iTunes. You can also stream us live on Facebook. And just ahead, all of the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. Get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, all about a new music show debuting this summer on 89.9, Hotsy Totsy. Plus, hip-hop artist Rashad Newsom and his new exhibit in downtown Jax. All of that and more ahead. But first, it's Friday and a busy news week to discuss as we welcome our media roundtable. Andrew Pantazzi of the Florida Times Union is here. Hey, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Tim Gibbons, editor at the Jacksonville Business Journal.
Good to be here.
And David Cotton, who writes for the Daily Record.
Good morning.
Guys, so good to see you. Thanks for being here. Lots to discuss this week, everything from a special session in Tallahassee to Senator Nelson's trip to town to examine the city's opioid crisis and more. But our top story this Friday, reaction coming in fast and furious, both here in Florida and around the world, after President Trump yesterday announced he's pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord. Now, while most big city mayors around the country spoke out strongly against Trump's decision, Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry defended it on social media, saying it's all about jobs. However, since Florida is the state most vulnerable to the impacts of sea level rise related to carbon emissions, there is a lot to discuss here. Right off the bat, we want your calls and comments. What's your reaction to the president's decision to pull out of the Paris Accord on climate? Give us a call at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, or weigh in on our Facebook page. Andrew Pantazzi, let's begin with you. Mayor Lenny Curry sticking up for the president on this decision, at odds with other Florida mayors and many other big city mayors around the country who see this as a mistake. What's been the reaction locally in Jacksonville?
So I don't know exactly what the reaction has been since the mayor's tweet yesterday or since the president's official announcement. I think a lot of people were expecting this. But I do see that there's a lot of reaction coming from the gubernatorial candidates. I think this will be a major issue for the 2018 campaigns. And it'll be interesting to see how Adam Putnam, the lead candidate for the Republican Party, responds, as well as looking at how between Gwen Graham and Andrew Gillum, who are competing for the Democratic nomination, how they respond. But I do think one of the things that we've seen that's different is Mayor Curry was formerly the head of the Republican Party of Florida, and he shows a closer tie, I think, to national Republican politics than the previous mayors that we've had. I don't think I think that this is a departure from what we saw with John Delaney or John Payton or Ed Austin, the last three Republican mayors, or even when Alvin Brown was mayor. Despite his close connections to the Democratic Party, you did not see as close of ties to Barack Obama when he visited Jacksonville. So I think we're seeing kind of a different type of mayorship when it comes to party politics.
David Cotton, Congressman Carlos Curbelo, Republican in South Florida, has teamed up with a Democratic congressman in Florida, Ted Deutch, to form the House Climate Caucus. They were on national television last night expressing their disappointment with this decision on the Paris Accord by the president. None of our local delegation up here in North Florida, Congressmen Rutherford, Yohor, DeSantis, have joined this caucus, however.
No, they haven't. And, you know, I think it's not surprising that, you know, a South Florida-based, you know, representative would jump on this because, you know, I think that's kind of been the narrative is that, you know, Florida is going to go underwater, you know, if we pull out of this thing. And so I don't think that's surprising. I think, you know, it also, again, wasn't surprising to see Mayor Curry, you know, comment on this. But, you know, Gwen Graham has been pretty, as a gubernatorial candidate, she's been pretty clear that, you know, she's going to fight for the environment. Adam Putnam has, you know, supported Trump in the past. So I expect that probably to continue.
Andrew.
I was just going to add, I mean, it's also important to remember when we talk about this, that even people who now are very, who are speaking out, who are very upset at the withdrawal from this pact, originally were very upset with the Paris Accord because, one thing, it was not a treaty because President Obama didn't think he could get it passed through Senate. It does not have any enforcement arm of it. It was kind of a good faith deal of countries saying we're each going to try to do our best to meet these goals. And so originally there were a lot of environmentalists who thought it didn't go nearly far enough and it didn't have enough measures in place to ensure people were actually abiding by the actual meat of the deal.
Right, that idea that one of the, you know, one of the three countries now that we're in the basket with of people who have not signed on to this is Nicaragua, who wanted to make it even greener.
They thought it didn't go far enough.
And it is one of the interesting things about the argument that this places such a huge burden on the U.S. when the entire thing is voluntary. The
accord was structured taking into account U.S. considerations.
Right. There's actually an argument that it's a good thing that the U.S. pulled out from the standpoint that if they were inside, not basically abiding by it, but still being a signatory to it, it was voluntary. There was no enforcement mechanism. So basically, the U.S. could keep on going along doing environmental policies that would not have helped with climate change, but still be a signatory to the thing. At this point, America's abdicating its leadership officially, as opposed to basically abdicating its leadership anyhow, but, you know, not declaring that.
I was just going to add, I mean, I think the biggest thing that we have to look to see is how do some of the other countries respond. So not necessarily the European countries that are responding by saying, oh, we're going to be the leading the way on this. But how does China respond?
That is interesting. China's stepping up, which is what...
Is the U.S. abdicating its position, you're saying, pulling out of this agreement as a leader in the world?
There's an argument that the entire American, make America great, American first sort of idea is basically saying we're an isolationist country now, where, you know, pulling out of TPP basically cedes Asian trade to China. Pulling out of this cedes climate change leadership to China and Europe. Obviously there is a portion of the populace that actually thinks that's a good political move. It will be interesting to see how it moves forward, particularly on that job level. If you say say alternative energy is the, you know, energy of the future, China's leading the way in solar panel production. That's something that arguably you'd want to have happen here in the U.S., but if we're not doing solar power, that's not going to happen.
And Fred Matthews, what about the president's argument that he's the president of the people in Pittsburgh, not Paris? The mayor of Pittsburgh tweeted out immediately after that statement, here in Pittsburgh, we stand with the Paris Accord. More of our jobs are being created through renewables than fossil fuels.
I think that is exactly the president's position, and it is a position that's supported by those who voted for him, and he is fulfilling exactly what he said he would do, and that is pull out of this accord. There should be no surprise with that. Look, even though there is international rancor about this, particularly in Europe, the issue, America is still the big economic engine for the planet right now. Even though China may step up, and because China has to, I mean, the smog in Beijing is as bad as it was in L.A. 20 years ago. They really have no choice but to step up and clean out the carbon there, or else they're not going to get tourists to come and visit. So, but in terms of the economic engine, what makes it work, all the money, the diversity of the U.S., the world still has to flow through here. The money still has to flow through the U.S. And I think the president is making this calculation based on economic and job terms, because after all, this is about the future. He is the president of now. Business is about now. It's not, yes, you're planning for the future, but the jobs that those folks are looking for in Appalachia are is about now. It's not about 20 years from now. Today, they need a job. They need to get back to work.
But it's not now. They're looking at the past. I mean, this will not make coal jobs come back. Coal jobs aren't coming back. I grew up in coal country. Coal jobs ain't coming back.
It was the same argument that you had at the turn of the century when the Titans were broken up, when Standard Oil was broken up because we didn't want monopolies, and they broke up Standard Oil. So what happened? All we did was give the oil to several smaller companies, and J.P. Morgan and Chase and all these other folks that just had stock in all the smaller companies and kept their monopoly going. They just did it by remote control. This is about now, and that's what the president is acting on. He's acting on the politics of now and the jobs of now, and these
folks. about Tim's argument that the jobs just aren't there in that sector anymore?
Well, that's the point. We need to, they're saying that they can make the jobs there. That is an argument that, yes, you can use coal to power the new power that's coming up. You can use coal to power the fans that we're looking at putting out in the ocean to generate more electricity. You can use the same way in which they use shale.
David Cotton.
Well, I think if you're going to talk about it now, let's put it in perspective as well. I mean, we can't actually pull out of this thing until 2020.
Right.
And to be
that's
honest
gotten,
with you,
by the way, that's gotten lost in all of this.
Well, right. And also,
yeah,
you
we're
gotta,
in this till 2020.
Well,
no
and also,
what.
You have to think too. Trump very well may not be the president after 2020. There's a very good likelihood that that could happen. And, you know, 2020 is also another milestone where countries who are in this accord actually have to present a longer term deal for this. So at the end of the day, this could just be a lot of, the president just, you know, making a stance here that could ultimately be reversed.
All right, let's go to your calls on this. Lots of calls at 549-2937. Cameron in St. Augustine. Go ahead, Cameron.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on today.
Sure.
How are you guys doing this morning?
Great, thanks.
Cool. I just wanted to comment, I guess, real quick. I don't know. I'm not a scientist or anything, but I like to do research. And for the people who don't believe in global warming, I would recommend parking your car in the garage, leaving it running, and then staying the night in the garage and tell me if you don't believe it in it in the morning. You know, I hate to say it like that, but, you know, carbon dioxide's bad, and we're burning it into an enclosed environment. So it's a problem, and I'm glad you guys are talking about it, and thank you very much. Have a
okay.
good one.
Okay, thanks, Cameron. Andrew Pantazzi, what this ultimately comes down to is that the president does not accept the settled science, frankly, around climate change.
Yeah, I mean, it's unclear right now exactly what the president does believe.
Change or in general?
We do know that during the campaign, he said climate change was a hoax invented by the Chinese, that it was intended to decrease American competitiveness. Don't know if he still believes that it is a vast global conspiracy started by the Chinese or not. But it does come down to a question of, do you believe in climate change, and do you believe that humans make an impact on climate change, or do you think it's a natural course that's running its way through? Because that's what we saw with Marco Rubio when he ran. He said, I believe in climate change, but I question the impact that humans make on it. So even there, we had seen the goalposts shifting in the Republican Party, but Donald Trump has now taken it to a new level where we're not sure exactly what the Republican Party believes about climate change.
There is an interesting orthodoxy there. The Republican Party does not think that we should deal with climate change. Good chunks of it have moved to it exists and it's a thing, but we shouldn't. Should we do something about it? What should we do? There's uncertainty there. So it's
not in South Florida where Republican mayors are seeing the water come in and they're acting. They're doing stuff.
I don't know. When Mar-a-Lago is underwater, I assume at that point something will happen.
But that's the point, Tim. That's in the future. That's in the future. We're about job. This is about jobs now. It's about finding ways to get jobs back up for folks now within the next, really, 8 years if he can pull it off. But it's about jobs now. That's what this is about. Reality check, though, for those folks who think this is a big deal, exactly what you just mentioned. We can't pull out of the deal until 3 days after the election in 2020. In November of 2020 is the earliest he can pull out, unless he takes a nuclear option right now and says he's going to pull out of everything tomorrow, which you can't legally do because we're so intertwined. So this is about politics.
It is.
It always
all right,
was.
All right. Lindsay in San Marco. Go ahead, Lindsay.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Sure.
I wanted to say that I find the argument that this is about jobs to be kind of an empty argument, quite frankly. Right now, wind and solar employ more people than the entire fossil fuel industry. The way forward isn't as difficult as we've been led to believe. And yes, you know, this will benefit us 10, 20 years down the road, but China and India are getting ready to invest billions next year. I read in the Business Journal, China is slated to have a third of alternative energy jobs by 2020. That's not that far away. So I think any argument that, oh, this is about jobs that we need right now, I kind of find that empty and misleading. And I appreciate you guys for having me on.
Thank you, Lindsay. David Cotton?
Well, I think that argument is coming from the president, and also speaks to who has the president's ear right now. It's very obvious now that the more right wing of his administration, the Steve Bannons, have his ear versus the Ivanka Trump, the Jared Kushners in his office. So, you know, but that's going to be the argument from the president that, you know, it's this whole nostalgic make America great again, coal jobs are what we're fighting for.
549-2937. Tom is on the West Side. Hello, Tom. Good morning.
Good morning. I had two quick points I wanted to make. First, I wonder if anyone has ever explained to Donald Trump that America First was the phrase that Charles Lindbergh used to go from international hero to worldwide pariah. And the second thing, speaking directly about the jobs, is I am from West Virginia, and I can tell you that even in the height of the coal days, West Virginia did not have enough jobs to sustain its economy. And that's why you see so many West Virginians here in Florida. Just no jobs up there, even with coal. And finally, let me quote Bill Cosby from NOAA to all Floridians. How long can you tread water?
I don't know that quote, but I appreciate that thought. Thank you, Tom. Okay, Tim, you grew up in coal country, as you mentioned. What about his comments?
There is. I mean, coal's been dying. I mean, coal is a, you know, kind of ineffective heating source. It obviously helped build the country, but it's not just dying because of climate change. It's been dying for years. It's not a job that many people want to do. Dangerous, hard work, and I can see why in some ways it's seen as a ennobling sort of thing. People, you know, have put their lives and their generations of families' lives into it, but it's something that's going away. There's a certain amount of this entire conversation really is more about singling than anything else, you know, basically standing on which side you stand on. I do wonder how much of the president's decision is coming back after a trip in which it was at least perceived that he was widely mocked by European leaders as basically going, oh, a bunch of eggheads who believe in climate change. Well, you know,
we'll show them
expletive you
freedom fries.
Yeah, exactly. It's you know, we're not one of those people, sort of thing.
Well, we're getting a lot of tweets about this. Rob tweets the show: Jacksonville and JEA should broker electricity with solar panels on every roof and on road medians. Wean us off coal and gas. JEA does have some solar in their mix.
They have a huge solar farm, actually, that they get stuff from.
Yeah. Madeline, where are we? Doug, there are more jobs now in the green tech sector of California alone than the entirety of the coal industry. And he writes, expand that to the nation, fund training, and you'll have jobs now coming out of your ears. Lots of feedback on this, but we do need to move on and talk about some of the other stories of the week. If you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Media Roundtable, 549-2937. And guess what? They're going back to a special session in Tallahassee again.
Who would have thunk it?
Governor Scott and legislative leaders have struck a deal for a 3-day special session tentatively set for June 7th through the 9th. They're going to make the formal announcement at 10 o'clock this morning. Now, this special session will include proposed legislation dealing with everything from public education to Enterprise Florida and Visit Florida and, yes, medical marijuana. Lots to go over as everyone was waiting, Fred and Andrew, to see whether the governor was going to sign off on the $82.4 billion state budget or veto it. Now they're going to go back and thrash it out some more.
Well, I mean, the governor was approaching the deadline to make some hard decisions, and it was clear that there was some politics being played between the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate on these issues, particularly the governor's pet projects having to do with Enterprise Florida and supporting business. Again, gentlemen, business is what we're supporting in this state. And, of course, the issue of the fact that the legislature is just too timid to take a stand on medical marijuana. We're afraid of folks smoking it, so this special session almost had to happen. What will come out of it, though, is anybody's guess. If I was going to wager a guess, I'd say the governor will probably get money for his for his Enterprise, Florida deal, but medical marijuana won't get very much going on.
Well, it's just the will of the voters. I mean, you know, you're supposed to do with that.
Andrew.
No, I mean, it's true. There's a lot of, surprise, surprise, politics happening in Tallahassee.
Whoa.
I know, whoa. So, I mean, we'll see. Everyone's got priorities. And right now, the Speaker of the House and the governor, what's been going on for a year, is their priorities are completely opposite. I think it's clear that both of them eye future office. The question is whether Richard Corcoran is going to run for something in 2018. And if he does, does he want to have the victory of saying, I denied the governor his corporate welfare, I denied funding to go to visit Florida and to big corporations, which is what the governor is asking for. And meanwhile, the governor's gearing up presumably for a run as well. And does he want to look like in his final 2 years in office that he was battling with another Republican over who's more conservative?
There are fascinating fault lines in the Republican Party that were displayed here. I mean, on a range of business issues, where you have, you know, some of the changes that they were looking at in insurance basically became this fratricidal fight amongst Republicans. The Visit Florida, Enterprise Florida thing is two radically different wings of the Republican Party going at loggerheads, where the idea of saying that a Republican-controlled state could not do an incentive policy is just, you know, 10 years ago that you know, no one would have thought that.
It's a much more libertarian view of the role of government. It's a view that says that businesses should come to Florida on their own without taxpayers having to pay to incentivize them. And that's completely at odds with Governor Scott's way of thinking, which is, no, it's all about jobs, jobs, jobs. Whatever gets us jobs, that's what we need to do, even if that means using taxpayer funding for big corporations.
Now, not only that, when they go back into session, David Cotton, they're going to go over this controversial schools bill, HB 7069, that parents and school boards have begged the governor to veto. They see this as crippling traditional public education. Charter school advocates disagree.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I guess the argument there is that, you know, we should be funding our public schools and not putting so much money into charter schools. But, you know, I think when I saw the email come into my inbox today about, you know, all three of these men meeting and having this big announcement a couple minutes after we leave here today, it just speaks to some sort of compromise. It seems like Corcoran's going to get something for his education bill, and Scott's going to get something for his Enterprise Florida. Speaking towards education, though, you know, Mark Wilson, who was the president and CEO of the Florida Chamber, was in town this week, and he told us, you know, the incentives, you know, they're great and everything, but, you know, public education, the legal climate, tax structure, those are the big things. So he was also sort of trying to downplay this, you know, incentives are a big deal as well.
Now, you mentioned Governor Scott looking to take a run at Bill Nelson for the U.S. Senate. While Nelson was in town this week, U of Health, Jack's Doctors, and the hospital's CEO say more money is needed to deal with babies born addicted to opioids. That was the message to Senator Nelson when he visited the hospital's NICU on Tuesday. He said the AHCA, the American Health Care Act, could be detrimental to opioid treatment.
Their decision today to search again for the data recorder, it's a critical step.
And that is another quote by Bill Nelson about something completely different. But I'll try to paraphrase what he said. Basically, he bashed the American Health Care Act, which is Capitol Hill Republicans' repeal and replace effort for Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act.
It's going to be interesting how the Republicans deal with the opioid crisis. I mean, the idea that we've had a change in thinking in drug, in basically how much help people dealing with opioids need. Some would argue that that's as it has become more of a thing affecting white people, quite frankly. But many of the Trump supporting communities were very hardly hit by the opioid crisis, and much of the policies that he's putting into place do not seem to be helping those communities.
Namely, thinking of Attorney General Jeff Sessions revoking the Eric Holder memos and reinstating the John Ashcroft memos of the early 2000s, which say, if this is your third drug offense, even if it's half an ounce of marijuana, you go to prison for the rest of your life. And that is the mandatory sentencing that you will receive and how that will affect people who are caught with fentanyl and other opioids on their person.
Right. And here in Duval County, we have the highest amount of cases after Pinellas County in the state. The morgue here in Duval County, Fred, says they literally cannot keep up with the overdose deaths, bodies literally piling up at our morgue. We've seen a huge spike in addicted babies being born with a rash of health problems that are going to follow them throughout their lives. This is a massive public health emergency.
Yeah, the interview that you had with the medical examiner some weeks ago, I mean, just drove it home to everybody when the medical examiner has to turn away bodies and send them back to the hospital until they can get the room there. Look, it's going to be left up to the states to make any corrections on this on the criminal side of the opioid addiction issue. Again, driven home to an extent, you can say, what are we going to charge Tiger Woods with this week? What are you going to charge him with? It's obviously it wasn't alcohol. It has to do something with painkillers or something that he was taking. So it's going to be left up to the states to deal with this. And that's why it's important that we take a close look at what our legislators are doing in Tallahassee when it comes down to this issue. It doesn't necessarily have to be a quick fix, but they do have to look at adjusting that. And of course, it's going to be left up to the states to decide how medically they're going to support their constituency.
Chuck at the beaches. Go ahead, Chuck.
Hey, guys, I'll be quick. It came out yesterday that the state of Ohio is suing five of the major drug corporations over the opioid problem, and this is on NPR.org. I'll read you one sentence from NPR.org. All things considered notes, the state of Ohio estimates some 200,000 people within its borders are addicted to opioids, a number roughly the same size as Akron, Ohio. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you for that, Chuck. All right, we want to make note of one other headline that just crossed overnight. Charges against two of the five people arrested during a violent protest in Heming Park back in April have been dropped. The state attorney's office says it will drop charges against deaf protester Connell Crooms and protest organizer Dave Schneider. The other three of the so-called Heming Park Five are expected to take a plea deal. This all gained national attention after a video went viral showing police officers attacking one of the protesters and punching him, actually. But the state's attorney's office taking the road that I think many expected her to take. But what are your thoughts about this, guys?
It's an elections have consequences sort of thing. I mean, I'm pretty confident saying that under Angela Corey, these charges would not have been dropped. And you know, people wanted a different leader in that office. And I think people would have been fairly outraged if she had not made this decision.
Fred.
Yeah, I think it's the same way. It's an indicator that her office is going to take a good look at both sides of the fence and not criminalize something that did not need to be criminalized.
Will this affect Melissa Nelson's relationships with the JSO?
I mean, I don't know that how much this directly affects her relationship with JSO. We've already seen some issues that she's had with union leaders. Both a former union president and a current union president have been highly critical of her creating a new division that is intended to investigate elder abuse, human trafficking, and police abuse. They've been highly critical that she would do that, and they were also very in favor of Angela Corey. But I don't know that this particular event does. Her report that she released last night, the 45-page report, which also declined to charge one of the counter-protesters. She didn't get into any of the police actions, whether police force was warranted. So she didn't seem to be coming out making strong statements condemning police. However, she did say at least one of the charges was actually erroneous. The other charges, she simply said, there's not enough proof that she could have proven this, and so she's dropping those two. And the other ones, she said, due to the facts and circumstances, she's agreeing to a plea deal. The one charge that she found erroneous was the 74-year-old man who was punched repeatedly in the face by a police officer when he was trying to pull the officer off of someone. He was charged with a first-degree felony, which would have carried a significant prison term, and she said he should have been charged with a third-degree felony. But that was the only point in it that she said a charge was actually wrong for the police to have filed.
All right. And as you mentioned, Tim, elections have consequences. So This special edition of Only in Florida is just for you. Here it is for you right now, guys. Our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from the week. Luckily, there is never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now, Only in Florida, the election edition. And we don't have the music.
Don't have the music.
Oh, darn it. Oh, there we go.
There it is.
Okay. By the way, that's Gershwin's Swanee, a very Florida-centric tune for people that have always wanted to know what that music is.
Thank you.
Only in Florida does a rugby player named He-Man run for office. Yes. If Minnesota can elect Jesse the Body Ventura, maybe Florida can elect Christian He-Man Schlereth.
Whoa.
Woo. Schlereth qualified Tuesday for the Senate District 40 special election in Miami, and his name will appear that way on the ballot. Now, Schlereth filed a sworn affidavit attesting that his nickname is real. It's what his rugby teammates have called him for years. Schlereth is an adjunct sociology professor at Barry University, Miami-Dade College, and the University of Miami, running without party affiliation to replace Senator Frank Artiles, a Republican who resigned last month. And Schlereth says he intends to run as an anti-establishment candidate and bring something fresh to the state Senate.
I want the pro-establishment Hailei star to run against him, the person who says we need to really entrench the swamp, we need to bring more lobbyists into Tallahassee.
Don't you want to see He-Man on the floor of the Florida Senate? He-Man, pass that bill already.
Does he have the power, is the question.
I'm just going to call him the S-Man.
I just want to hear, I give the floor to my respected colleague, Mr. He-Man.
Skeletor has been a nickname. I'm just revealing I know way too much about He-Man. But Skeletor has been a nickname for a certain Florida politician.
His real name, though. His actual name.
Pronounce it.
I just know I have a couple of nicknames I would not want showing up on a ballot.
All right. And only in Florida does a nasty neighbor pull the plug on a bouncy house at a kid's birthday party.
Yeah, I saw that.
What a jerk. A Port St. Lucie family was left with quite the deflated feeling after the neighbor was caught on video walking into the backyard, unplugging the bouncy house, and then walking back across the street. Nearly a dozen kids between the ages of 2 and 3 were inside as the house started to fall on top of them. Chaos ensued. The kids were in tears. Police believe the man was trying to pull the plug to the DJ booth at the party instead of the bouncy house.
What type of party has a DJ booth and a bouncy house?
I feel like
in Port St. Lucie.
I feel like my childhood is missing something now. I never had a DJ.
I never had a bouncy house or a DJ. I never had a birthday party.
But did he yell to
get off
there?
I think I had one at McDonald's when I was 10.
No, he just went and pulled the plug down.
There was no get off my lawn.
No, just pull the plug.
Yeah, he didn't say get off my lawn. He just pulled the plug. Anyway, it's never, ever a shortage of jokes and fun with this crew as we discuss the serious news and the crazy news. Always good to see you guys. Andrew Pantazzi, David Cotton, Tim Gibbons, and Fred Matthews. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
We'll be right back.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
Hi, this is Chris Thiele. Join us this weekend for a Prairie Home Companion from the Fitzgerald Theater in St. Paul with our guests, the one, the only Paul Simon, Andrew Bird, and the hilarious Maria Bamford. We also had some of my fellow Punch Brothers in the band, plus Sarah Jarosz, Rich Dworsky, and the Royal Academy of Radio Actors. Hope you'll join us.
Saturday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
Are you looking for clear and concise car advice?
See, we got all that heat in the engine. There's got to be a way to use the heat instead of using the alcohol.
Well, that's why I recommend having a quick coupling so you can put the bottle back in there.
Yeah, but that's a royal pain.
He's in Alaska. You don't think that's a royal pain? I mean, this is just one more pain. Royal pain. For more well-reasoned car advice, join us this week for the best of Car Talk. Saturday mornings at 10 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
When Sheryl Sandberg was a little girl, the other kids used to call her bossy. But then she did become the boss, number 2 at Facebook. And today, she asks audiences all the time,
"Please raise your hand if as a boy you were ever called bossy." No hands go up.
But when she asks women,
all the hands go up.
I'm Guy Raz. Lessons from Leaders next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Sundays at noon on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, the board of directors of the American Medical Association has announced a big honor for Jacksonville's Dr. Jim Burt. Burt is a 2017 Excellence in Medicine Award winner for his work and dedication in helping this area's working uninsured and in co-founding Volunteers in Medicine. Dr. Jim Burt, thanks for being with us. Congratulations.
Well, thank you for having me.
Real high honor for you to get this. It's a big deal.
It is, but you know, most of the credit ought to be going to the people who volunteer and work and do such a great job for the people that are underserved in Jacksonville.
That's right. It is called Volunteers in Medicine.
Correct.
And it's all about helping the working uninsured get the care they need. You created this, so you've made a big impact with this.
Well, thank you very much. I did, but you know, you do things and you enjoy them, and you do that because you enjoy seeing people get care and get to feeling better.
Now, you retired from the McIver Clinic in 2001 as a urologist. And can you tell us a little bit about what sparked you to become the impetus to found Volunteers in Medicine?
Well, when I retired, I didn't want to just sit around and dry up like a prune. So I thought I wanted to do something for the community. And I had two or three ideas, maybe be an ombudsman for patients. And then I met Dottie Dorian at some sort of social event, and she said, "How you doing? What you doing when you're tired?" And I told her I was just sort of thinking about doing something for the community. And so we talked a bit, and she started thinking about it, and then I got back with her, and we found the Volunteers in Medicine program in Hilton Head, South Carolina. I called Dr. McConnell up there and said, "I'm interested in doing something for town. Can you help me?" And he said, "Sure, come up to see me." And I said, "When do you want me to come?" He said, "This weekend." So my wife and I went up there and spent a delightful weekend with a very wonderful man. And he sort of gave us a lot of help to getting things started and how to do.
Yeah. And what VIM does is retired and active medical professionals all volunteer to provide treatment to the working uninsured. You deliver more than $5 in services for each dollar you receive in donations. This is a model for free family medical care that has reduced emergency room visits and acute care urgencies for a really hardworking but vulnerable population. And the need is great.
It is great. And it looks like it's going to be greater as the nation moves on with different plans for health care. Health care in the emergency room is wonderful, but it's spasmodic, episodic, and very, 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 very costly. And in my practice, I would see people come in and they didn't have any insurance, and that you had a hard time knowing what to do with them. If you ordered a test, they couldn't afford it. And so this just all came together as asking every friend that I had in town to help me.
And they did.
They did. That's right.
Yeah.
That's the great part of the story.
And it's nice to see you recognized. You're going to receive this prestigious national honor at the AMA's annual meeting Friday, June 9th in Chicago. What do you see as the role of volunteers in medicine, as you said, as we look ahead to an uncertain path when it comes to health insurance in this country? We don't know what the final outcome is going to be about what's going on politically.
Right. Even with the Affordable Care Act as it now stands, there are still numbers of people who are in between. They're in that crack between being available to free care through some public system, and having enough money to meet deductibles and care with the healthcare system. And when we started, we found that there were about somewhere between 80 and 120,000 people in Jacksonville who had no regular physician. And so when we got started on this, we thought, this is what we want to focus on. The clinic now opens. It's open 5 days a week. We have an in-house internist who manages the clinic. We have an agreement with UNF for students to come over. We have nurse practitioner students. We have nursing students who come. They sit down with patients one-to-one and talk to them about their diabetes or whatever else they have. It's just a wonderful experience, and people who come down really love it. The docs like it because they don't have to worry about how many people they're going to see or what the time frame is. And so it works well, and I think it's a happy place for yeah. patients and for volunteers.
It is, and congratulations once again.
Thank you so much.
I appreciate
it.
Hope you have a good time at that ceremony, Dr. Jim Burt. co-founder of Volunteers in Medicine. Up next, artist Rashad Newsome, and also the debut of our new music show, Hotsy Totsy. Stay with us.
I'm Joshua Johnson. Coming up on 1A, you know, there are some weeks when the news just does not make sense.
The president and a small group of people know exactly what he meant.
There's a lot for us to figure out in plain English, I promise, on the Friday News Roundup. Next time on 1A. Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
On the next Fresh Air, we continue our celebration of the Beatles on this 50th anniversary of the release of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, and listen back to our interviews with Paul McCartney and Ringo Starr. I hope you'll join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. Well, artist Rashad Newsome works in video, performance, and collage, and he remixes seemingly chaotic expressions of street culture into formal compositions. Newsome mashes up hip-hop and European traditions as a way to celebrate African-American culture, and he's in Jacksonville to debut a fabulous new video installation, The Conductor. This opens tomorrow at the Museum of Contemporary Art. We've got a preview as we welcome the artist. Rashad Newsome, good morning.
Good morning.
This sounds really cool. How did this all come together?
Well, I started the piece in 2005, and it really came from a real deep love for Karl Orff's Carmina Burana, which is considered one of the most epic choral pieces to date.
Right.
And I was really fascinated with how widely sampled the piece was. And I was doing a lot of work about hip-hop culture, and I was thinking a lot about how, you know, sampling is very deeply rooted in the practice of hip-hop. And but then also when I transcribe the lyrics from the pagan poems that make up the piece, they really mirrored a lot of the lyrics in popular hip-hop music, you know, like gluttony, sex, war, the fickleness of wealth, you know, it was sort of like medieval hip-hop.
How funny. So it's the mashing up of these what seem to be very disparate genres, but really aren't, that kind of brings the magic. But there's video in this, too.
Yeah, there's video. So, you know, what I did was I did a survey with, it's funny that I'm in a radio station because I spent a lot of time in radio stations building this piece, but I did a survey with Hot 97 and 105.1, which are New York's like top hip hop radio stations. And I did that survey between 2005 and 2014. And, it was, you know, I was asking the public who they considered to be the most epic MCs and producers in the hip hop genre. And then from this material, I collected those artists' videos and then motion tracked their hand movements frame by frame, and that library of hand movements became the material that I edited to conduct the piece. But sort of to add another layer to it, I took samples from the artists whose hands were in the video and used those samples to remix each one of the six movements of the piece.
So people's minds are basically going to be blown when they come to this thing tomorrow night. And this is all debuting tomorrow night at MoCA, and there's going to be some performance too, correct?
Yeah, as an extension.
Oh, tonight, rather. It's tonight.
Tonight,
yeah.
Yes. Tonight. And as an extension of the piece, what I do is whenever it's presented, there's a performance score that's given to the presenting institution. And, you know, I invite either an artist who is in the video or an artist of my choosing to perform in response to the video. And it's just a way to kind of, you know, sort of like bring the performative nature of emceeing into the space in real time, but also become a platform for new voices.
It sounds fascinating, but I can tell just listening to you and reading about this that you really have to see this to get it. It's something that just has to be experienced. Mm-hmm. So people just need to come out tonight to MoCA and see you and meet you and see this new exhibit. I don't think there's been anything quite like it at the museum there before. It's called The Conductor, and we're lucky it's going to be here through September, or early September.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool. Well, it's a pleasure to meet you, and have fun visiting Jacksonville. He's artist Rashad Newsome. This exhibit debuts tonight at the Museum of Contemporary Art. It's called Synthesize Art and Music, and his installation is The Conductor. Go check it out. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And finally this hour, a little Duke Ellington to get you off into your weekend. We've got a brand new summer music show to talk about here on 89.9 Hotsy Totsy. It's popular music from the 1920s and 30s, all played on the original 78s. Music director David Luckin dreamed this up, and he joins us now. Good morning.
There's your
hip-hop. It's the bee's knees.
Yeah, there's your hip-hop from the 20s.
That's right.
1928, Duke Ellington. Some of you may know this song because, I'm trying to remember the people that did it in the 70s. Darn, that just slipped my mind.
What, did Duke Ellington's It Don't Mean a Thing?
It's okay.
You ain't got that swing?
We're going to play the original 78s. We're going to play all the great music from the 20s and 30s every Sunday night for the summer on 89.9 and on your app. So if you like to listen online or on your app, you will be there Sundays for Hotsy Totsy.
Now, you came up with the name for this because there's a song called Hotsy Totsy.
There sure is.
From that era, right?
The California Ramblers, and they were very, very successful back then. And I just handed Melissa an old 78 from 1920. There's your Swanee from your Only in Florida.
Yeah, and now I'm holding an original 78. You bought these. These were played on gramophones.
Victrolas.
These are really thick records.
Yes.
The kind they made back then.
Yeah, they're pretty heavy, and they break very easily, but they don't scratch very easily. So you can beat them up to a point. And Steely Dan was who I was trying to think of. They did a cover of East St. Louis Toodaloo in the 70s. So good music lasts forever. They're going to be playing hip-hop 50 years from now. We're still playing Duke Ellington 70 and 80 years from when it happened. So we're going to have fun Sunday nights. We invite everyone to tune in. And we've actually got a little bit of our theme song if we want to play a little Hotsy Totsy, and you know what this whole show is about.
I love the scratchy sound from these 78s.
And we're not cleaning
takes you
them
right. Yeah, you're playing it as they sounded. And Hotsy Totsy, that's a little slang. As you were talking, I decided to look up some 1920s slang just for fun, okay?
And what do they say Hotsy Totsy means?
It means pleasing.
Yeah, and I looked it up and someone
pleasing.
Someone gave the definition as almost perfect.
Yeah. Which is just like your music shows. They're almost perfect.
We try.
Here's a few more slang terms from the 20s. Horse feathers.
Also the name of a Marx Brothers movie. But
if you were like going to swear, you'd say
horse feathers. Yes. Or Godfrey Daniel instead of the other GD word.
All right. Here's a few more. Don't take any wooden nickels.
Yeah, I like that.
You know what that means?
We said it when I was a kid. Fake ones. If you try to use a coin like from an amusement park into a vending machine,
it means don't do anything stupid.
Yeah, oh, okay, that too.
Cat's pajamas.
That means it's pretty cool.
Pretty cool. Bee's knees. We knew that one.
We're playing.
You're the bee's knees, David. You're the bee's knees,
and you're very keen.
All right. Here's a few more. Juice joint.
Juice joint. I would think a speakeasy.
Speakeasy. Yeah. See, that's now when you think of this music, that's what you think of.
Yeah,
Prohibition.
The jazz age.
The jazz age.
And what's interesting is the 20s music is all reckless abandon. There's alcohol, fast cars, short skirts. And then the 30s music is kind of anti-depression music because the bottom has fallen out of all that fun of the 20s. So you've got really positive music, but built on something that was really pretty horrible. So Fred Astaire singing Things Are Looking Up when things really weren't, but it helped people get through the depression.
And you're going to play on this show every Sunday night. Night at 9, the music from the jazz age, the go-go-go era,
and the 30s
music, the depression era.
Right. So it goes from everything's hotsy-totsy to Brother, Can You Spare a Dime?
Right.
Which is interesting. But it's all great music. And for many Americans, the first time they heard jazz was on a 78 because it hadn't come on the radio yet and it spread across the land.
Tune in beginning this Sunday night for Hotsy-Totsy.
And every Sunday until August.
It's the new music show from that palooka, that old palooka, David Luckin.
That's it.
Let's close with a little more music, and that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Merchart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. We love your feedback. Send emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And never miss a show. Download the WJCT app or listen on iTunes. Up next on 1A, the weekly news roundup. And make sure to catch an encore of this show tonight at 8 o'clock. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world.
And she's my totsy, so everything is a hotty totsy now.